You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The results of the 2010 midterms are mostly in. Republicans are going to take control of the House. The Senate stays with the Democrats. Joining us now are Rolling Stone contributing editor Matt Taibbi. He's the author of Griftopia, Bubble Machines, Vampire Squids, and the Long Con that is breaking America. And New Yorker staff writer Jill Lepore, she's the author of The Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution and the Battle Over American History. I'm pleased to welcome both of them to our show today for the final installment of our election series, The Big Picture. Hello.
Hello.
And I throw this out to both of you. Didn't the vote go pretty much as expected? Did anything surprise you, Matt?
I actually expected Reid to maybe lose. That was the only real surprise to me, that I thought that vote was going to be right down to the wire and maybe that the Republicans would pick that up. But otherwise, it kind of went exactly as I thought it would go.
Jill, were you surprised that Reid won? After all, Sharon Angle did everything possible to lose the election, didn't she?
I did think that was going to be closer than it was. And to read some of the Tea Party's concession speeches, it doesn't seem as though they lost when, in fact, they lost. Angle's concession speech is especially interesting in that regard. Or even O'Donnell's, you know, sort of it's a concession speech that works like a victory speech. You know, we are now just beginning this revolution, seems to be the message across the board for people who are supported by the Tea Party.
And Linda McMahon had a party, I gather, a defeat party that was one of the best parties anybody would have wanted to go to her party rather than Blumenthal's party.
I'm sure.
Caviar.
I'm sure they threw a fantastic party.
Yeah. The New York Times' Matt Bai wrote this morning that Republicans offered little to voters beyond an emphatic rejection of the president's policies. Well, didn't the president pretty much deliver on most of what he promised during the 2008 campaign? Did that turn out to not be what most Americans thought they were voting for 2 years ago?
I don't think necessarily that he delivered on everything. I think one of the things that Obama did is that he disappointed both his base and independents. I think there were a lot of people who were in the more liberal, you know, corner of the universe who expected Obama to be a change agent and to, you know, undertake sweeping reforms of Wall Street and roll back some of the Bush's more onerous policies, like, for instance, the Guantanamo Bay business. And he didn't really do a lot of those things, but he also didn't, he didn't create jobs. He didn't really speak to a lot of the voters who crossed the aisle to vote for him in 2008, and I think that was kind of his undoing. He tried to take the fork in the road, and he ended up losing both wings of his support.
Well, Jill, not just the people who crossed the aisle. Apparently, few minorities voted, and the older white conservative vote was overly represented. Will Obama be forced to abandon his African American base, which feels ignored or taken for granted, or will he risk the white opposition and deal more forcefully with the plight of African Americans, their higher rate of unemployment and foreclosures and those sorts of things?
I would be surprised if he would deal more forcefully, but you did really notice over the last couple of years that he lost control of the story that he told so well during the campaign. This, you know, every presidential aspirant needs to tell a story that amounts to "My life is the story of America," and he was able to do that so powerfully. He lost control of communication with the American public, certainly, in the first 2 years of his presidency. Whether he delivered or not is another question. But really, you know, the story of the election is mainly about the economy. But I think the demographics, to the extent that I've seen them, just as you suggest, older voters who turn up disproportionately at midterm elections really went in favor of Republicans and overwhelmingly supported. I think 47% of voters over the age of 30, over the age of 60, supported the Tea Party's agenda.
Polls indicate that 4 in 10 Americans say that things are worse for them today than they were just 2 years ago. Well, things were getting bad 2 years ago. They voted against Bush because things were worse for them than they had been before. Was it a matter of Obama just not coming through with enough, or were the laws that he proposed just not the best legislation?
Well, I think they committed at the outset. And here's the big mistake that I thought Obama made. This in 2008, when he got elected, both the economy and the Republican Party were in total disarray after his election, and this was an enormous opportunity for a Democrat with a powerful mandate like Barack Obama to sort of have a teaching moment about what had just happened to the economy, what had gone wrong, who is responsible, and where we can move forward and fix things. And they didn't do that. They didn't have that teaching moment. They didn't make important sweeping changes. And most importantly, what they did do, they pursued a strategy of we're going to try to save the economy by bailing out Wall Street first and hoping that that recovery trickles down to ordinary people. And of course, it didn't. They successfully bailed out Wall Street and got the stock market humming again. But it was a jobless recovery. The so-called benefits of this recovery have not extended to ordinary people, and that's allowed the Tea Partiers to make this argument that to offer all kinds of explanations about what's gone wrong that really aren't the contrast with reality.
You call the bank bailouts a monster collective project spanning two presidential administrations that was every bit as vast and far-reaching as Kennedy's trip to the moon.
Well, sure. I mean, this was, according to some estimates, this was, it could have been as much as a $12 or $13 trillion undertaking. It's a colossal economic undertaking, this bailout. Obama, when he got elected, he didn't do anything to distinguish himself from the bailouts that, as they had been undertaken by Bush. He brought back specifically some of the key architects of that bailout under Bush, most notably Tim Geithner, and he renominated Ben Bernanke. So there was total continuity with the Bush bailout program. You know, it's arguable whether they needed to do the bailouts or not, but he didn't do anything to distinguish himself, his bailout policies, from the previous administration.
Jill, you spoke to Tea Party members. The bailouts, including TARP, as Matt just pointed out, started under the Bush administration. Were they complaining at the time, or do they see this totally as something that Barack Obama has imposed on us?
Well, I don't know if Matt may have had similar experiences, but when I would talk to people in the Tea Party on exactly this point, they would say, well, I did oppose Bush's mm-hmm. economic policies as well, but I was in college then, and so I wasn't politically active, or, I was home with a young child those years, and so I was – there would always some reason, because when you asked, it turned out they had never actually done anything to express their opposition to Bush's economic policies. Well, they were very committed in retrospect to the idea that there had been a continuity of their beliefs throughout.
That's exactly my experience. Every time I talked to people and I said, well, where were you when Bush was running up record deficits and when he was, pushing through these radical bailout policies? Well, I was against it at the time, but I just didn't, I didn't say anything about it.
Were Tea Partiers wary about talking to either of you? Jill?
Well,
The New Yorker is seen as a liberal magazine.
Yeah, well, and I'm also a historian, and there's a lot of suspicion of the historical profession as having is sort of teaching a kind of left-wing lunacy version of American history in the academy. I teach at Harvard. Harvard is considered by a lot of these people to be a bedrock, a cradle of communism. So yeah, I think there were a lot of assumptions made about who I was, but people were very open and willing to talk to me, I would say. And I think, though, I think what the Tea Party gave to these people was actually not purely the opportunity to express anger, but there was a lot of inspiration. And a lot of these people feel really galvanized and inspired by the masterful use of the rhetoric of love of country and the idea that you could be a hero in this election by participating in the rescue of your country. That's actually a very compelling way to get people to vote. And I think for a lot of people that I spoke to, that felt really genuine.
But Maureen Dowd pointed out in her column today that the same sort of rhetoric was used against Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was no wild-eyed leftist radical, and I don't think Barack Obama is either. So what is the love of country really all about?
I don't know, but I would agree that there is this sense of it's all on us now. We're the people who have to rescue this country. Our own Republican Party abandoned us in the last 8 years, and now we have this Trotskyite monster occupying the White House, and we have to cut the heads off of this Hydra before it spirals out of control. And they really do they're very seduced by this narrative of we the people have to organize and rise up and do this all by ourselves. And you have to give them props because they have. As much as this is, in some respects, a top-down movement that's been funded by certain questionable sources and by powerful news networks like Fox News. It's also genuinely a grassroots organization that has done a remarkable job of galvanizing political energy, and we have to give them credit for that.
Jill, Matt points out that they were also rejecting the Republican Party. Now the Republican Party is stuck with the Tea Party. Some have welcomed that. Others see Sarah Palin as going to be a serious thorn in their side for a while now.
Yeah, well, people I talked to in the Tea Party all actually really disliked Palin. So there's a lot of ambivalence there. And, you know, as Matt and other people have observed, the Tea Party really is pretty diffuse. So what it will become is really anyone's guess.
Jane Mayer said that the Tea Party is really not all that diffuse. In fact, it's largely funded by people like the Koch brothers and just looks like it's diffuse.
Well, I'm not sure I wholly agree with that. I mean, yes, the story of where the money comes from is really important, and that piece of investigation is just phenomenal and really useful to the conversation that we're having here. But I do think, I mean, you know, when Beck asks, says on a show, what we're becoming is not who we are, you know, that really is the masterful. I think Beck and Palin's ability to talk about American values as something that has been lost is something that Democrats just have not really been able to do. I mean, we think about how to have national pride in a globalizing world is really a rhetorical problem as much as anything. And it's one that the Democrats really haven't stood up and been heard from on.
Rick Santelli's speech on CNBC, which is credited with starting the Tea Party movement in earnest, was about President Obama's mortgage assistance plan. He was asking people whether we should pay for our neighbor's stupidity, in effect. But it wasn't about the bailouts of the major banks. So is there a certain amount of misdirected anger here, Matt?
Well, I think that's the one of the key moments to really focus on with this whole history of the Tea Party. You know, we had already at that point when Rick Santelli gave that rant on CNBC, and this was in the beginning of 2009, there had already been well over $1 trillion in bailout monies spent primarily, almost exclusively actually, on the big banks who had gotten us into this mess in the first place. There had been an enormous effort to rescue banks and buy up the worthless mortgage assets that they themselves created. But none of that inspired widespread popular anger. What was the trigger was this Homeowner Affordability Act that Obama passed, which was really was direct mortgage assistance to low-income home borrowers who were largely minority home borrowers. And this is what struck a chord with a lot of these voters. It was hard for them to really see the results of the bailout, with their own eyes, the bank bailouts. But they could see the person next door who had maybe bought too much house now getting a bailout from the government, and that's what upset them.
But you're also suggesting there was a racial component here.
I think there was.
And Tea Partiers deny that racism is part of their agenda, but many people say that much of this has been mobilized by the fact that President Obama is black.
I think race is definitely a factor in the Tea Party's Tea Party movement. It's a factor on a number of levels. Among other things, there's a tremendous sense of outrage at the accusation that they're racist, which is a prime emotional motivating factor for these people to prove that they're not racist. But all the issues that they seem to be focusing on in some way or another come back to this whole issue of people who aren't carrying their weight and we're paying for them. And we know who those people are. So it's there. The racial aspect is there.
Jill, you write, it wasn't the whiteness of the Tea Party that I found most striking. It was the whiteness of their revolution. The founding fathers were the whites of their eyes, a fantasy of an America before race, without race.
Yeah, you know, just it's fascinating to me as an American historian to see the story of the revolution that the Tea Party, even the name, kind of embodies, you know, the parallel with the American Revolution. These people talk about the revolution. They dress up as revolutionaries. They're people who are very passionate in their interest in 18th century American history. But their sort of comic book version of American history, which is what most people, you know, understandably carry around in their heads, is entirely white. You know, it's this sort of there is no compromise over slavery in the Constitution. There is no sort of the long tradition in the United States of questioning the Constitution's inherent defects over the Three-Fifths Clause, et cetera. That's not part of the adoration for the Constitution that these people hold. And the view they have of the Constitution and of the revolution is just, you know, a bunch of white guys having a single idea, which is that they didn't want to pay their taxes anymore. That's really different from what the documentary evidence tells us. I mean, there was this kind of powerful moment in March when Glenn Beck unveiled in his studio these new three, Shepard Fairey style posters, replacing Obama's Hope poster, and it was Adams, Franklin, and Washington. You know, like these are the presidents that we should revere. We should go back to this moment because these people lived in a time where there were no divisions, where we all had a single voice, where we all loved the country. I mean, this fantasy that
it's not true. They were all fighting over everything, weren't they? That's why we have the Federalist Papers.
How could they have created such a brilliant document as the Constitution if they hadn't been through decades of intense political debate?
We have to take a little break. I want to come back to all of this. My guests are Jill Lepore, whose latest book is The Whites of Their Eyes. It's published by Princeton University Press. Matt Taibbi, whose latest book is Griftopia. It's published by Spiegel and Grau. Stay with us. My guests in this last installment of our Big Picture series, which has been going on before the election. Well, now we have had the election. My guests, Wednesday morning quarterbacking, are Matt Taibbi, whose latest book is Griftopia, Bubble Machines, Vampire Squids, and the Long Con That's Breaking America. It is published by Spiegel and Grau. And Jill Lepore, whose latest book is The Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution and the Battle Over American History. It's published by Princeton University Press. Much of the Tea Party movement focuses on deficits and government spending. In the lead-up to the election day, there was a lot of talk in the Democratic Party about extending the Bush-era tax cuts for the middle class, but letting them expire for the wealthy in order to address the deficit. That idea didn't gain traction with the Tea Party, even though it would cut back on the deficit. Why?
Well, because it's what they see it as a tax increase. What you're talking about is you're bringing into conflict two of their ruling ideas, which is that taxes need to be lowered or eliminated and budgets need to be decreased. So I think push comes to shove, they're always against a tax increase, but they don't have a real viable plan for how to get the budget under control because so many things, so many places where you'd want to cut are off the table for them, like defense, for instance. They have a vague idea about where the cuts need to come from, and they believe that there's this large amount of money that's being spent on low-income minority homeowners or something like that, and that's where 50% of the American budget is. It's just not the case.
Hey, Jill, did you talk to any of them about cutting defense spending?
Well, I did. That is off the table. That's one of the sort of elements of the movement that people refuse to talk about, that it's just really kind of beyond the pale. And it's partly because it's all veiled in this rhetoric of freedom. I mean, there's this piece Jim DeMint wrote, I guess, yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, that the mandate of the Tea Party is less government and more freedom. So when there will be discussion of taxes, it won't be just whether these taxes are about balancing the budget or not. There'll be the sort of high-fluting rhetoric of freedom and the idea that taxes constitute a conspiracy.
They're a use of force, as they say.
What effect do you think this is going to have on liberals who have been pretty much quiet? There have been a few who have been critical and got slapped down by the president's spokesman. But many liberals who have been withholding criticism on things like Afghanistan, which is one of the things that the Republicans actually like, do you think that they'll be emboldened to start speaking out about that and some of the other things where they have felt that the president has let them down?
I don't know. I think liberals have they have spoken out about some things. I think there was a lot of outcry during the healthcare debate about some of the things that the president did throughout that process. There's continuing dissatisfaction with some of his failures to roll back Bush's policies. I'm thinking about things like the Guantanamo Bay business. We're not out of Iraq yet. We're on our way to getting out of Iraq, but I think that there's going to be an effort now from the president to try in some way to placate what they see is a shift in attitudes by centrist and right-leaning voters, they're going to try to talk to those people and not to the liberals, not to their own base. And I think this is going to be a difficult time period for liberals because they're going to be ignored, I think.
Well, why don't they try, Jill, to claim a revolution in the same way that the Tea Party has?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what they're doing now is being defensive, defending themselves against the charge of hyperliberalism. I mean, there are all these sort of new labels being floated out, and you know, the word progressive has become a slur. So people and liberals in the base having a very hard time, I think, finding public space to answer.
Well,
answer
one of
that charge.
One of the results of this election is that. Conservatives won't have Nancy Pelosi to kick around anymore.
Right.
And she was a major target. Do they actually lose something by the fact that John Boehner is going to be the new majority leader?
I think, you know, as long as Obama's in the White House, they're going to have plenty of people to talk about it. You know, people always say that the Tea Party, these people aren't the same people who were voting for Bush back in the day, that there's a difference, they stand for different things. And I would argue that there's a tremendous continuity between the right-wing voters under Bush and this Tea Party movement, because what really defines them is who they're against. They're intensely focused on the same groups of people. They have a core group of people who they see are as un-American or as, you know, communist-leaning or socialist. And you can just sort of fill in the names, whether it's Barack Obama now or Bill Clinton back then. They're always going to have that enemy that galvanizes them. And to lose Nancy Pelosi is, I guess, probably a disappointment to the Glenn Becks of the world. But they'll find somebody else to fill that role.
My guests are Matt Taibbi, whose latest book is Griftopia, Jill Lepore, her latest book is The Whites of Their Eyes. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, Jill, one Tea Partier told you after the health care vote that he had recently started a committee to elect the corpse of Calvin Coolidge because anyone's better than Obama. Why was the health care initiative so galvanizing for the right, especially since polls indicate that the public likes many of the clauses in it?
I think it was the life and death element of it. I think that especially for older Americans who have day-by-day health care choices to be making, decisions to make about prescription drugs, decisions to make about whether to undertake this new treatment or to forego this treatment. The scare tactics around the death panel debate that summer, those town hall meetings, that was something pretty overwhelming for many, many people. And I think it brought out a lot of the old line issues that have been very volatile and divisive for the American people about abortion and kind of conflating abortion and euthanasia, that all that rhetoric about death and life and death choices. I think that brought a lot of vitality into this movement very early on.
Well, when the first health plans were proposed following Europe's lead during the Eisenhower administration, I guess even earlier during the Truman administration, Eisenhower called it creeping socialism. That hasn't changed, has it?
Right, and it's important to remember that those early healthcare proposals might have passed had they not also included provisions that would have forced Southern hospitals to desegregate. That was one of the reasons why a lot of the Southern Democratic politicians couldn't support those proposals back then. Otherwise, they might have had a good chance of passing along with some of those other things. Changes that were made back then. But there's, to me, I agree with Jill wholeheartedly, but I also think that there's a strong racial element to the outrage over health care. A lot of the people, the Tea Partiers who I interviewed, are actually on Medicare. It's an incredibly popular program, even among a lot of these people. But what they are very, very concerned about is this, what they see as an explosion of non-white immigrants who are coming in and who are going to be draining the federal budget, and they're paying the taxes for these people, and they see healthcare as a place where a lot of that money is going to go.
But they've also had posters that said, keep your government hands off my Medicare.
Right.
But isn't Medicare coverage expanded as a result of this legislation?
I believe it is. And I think a lot of these people, again, I think they think Medicare is a good program. I interviewed people in Kentucky who were sitting in motorized scooters that they had gotten from for free from the Medicare program, and they were sitting there at a rally denouncing the government takeover of health care. It's a very strange thing. It's subtle, but they see themselves as recipients of good welfare and the other people as recipients of bad welfare.
A listener, Mike from Tribeca, asks, weren't most of the Democrats who lost their House seats yesterday Blue Dog Democrats? Most of them were in Republican districts, and some people predicted when they won in 2008 that they'd be very vulnerable because of that. Some of them voted with the Republicans as much as with the Democrats, but that didn't seem to be enough.
Yeah. I remember, you know, in the last electoral cycle, when the Democrats made as many gains as they did, I had some friends who were in the House who said this is sort of an illusory victory on some levels because the kind of people who were electing doesn't really represent a strong shift in the other direction. It's we're electing very, very conservative Democrats in certain districts, and so I think we're seeing a mild rollback to, you know, Republican Party.
Well, the people are still for unemployment insurance and Medicare and Social Security. How do we explain, Jill, that Senate candidates Rand Paul in Kentucky, Marco Rubio in Florida, cruised to victory last night?
Well, I think that they tapped into really a wellspring of discontent, and I think that inconsistency in one's position was not really demanded of candidates in this election cycle. And just in the same way, you know, as Matt's talking about, that you're talking to people within the Tea Party who have their scooters and nevertheless want to decry government aid. Or, you know, I talked to people in the Tea Party who were paid entirely by the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense and nevertheless thought that the federal government was taking over our lives and needed to be stopped. So I think that there's been a kind of wild and chaotic and frenzied political conversation that that for all its ideological fervor has not actually demanded precision and has led to this, you know, a tremendous amount of political disequilibrium.
A listener asks, so will all elections from now on be about cognitive dissonance?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that people who are searching for consistency in the positions of these politicians are missing the point. These voters are – I was in Kentucky. I covered the Rand Paul business, and what's in it for a lot of the voters who are supporting Rand Paul is the horror that Rand Paul inspires in the people they despise. They see Rand Paul as being an anathema to the beliefs of the liberal politicians and the liberal individuals who they want to see run and hide. And I think they're less concerned with actual policy changes, and they're less concerned with what kind of laws these guys pass. They really just want to have that big football victory on election day and stick it to those other people.
What about the fact that his opponent ran a lousy campaign?
Well, there's that too, yeah.
Well, there were people who were supported by the Tea Party and by Sarah Palin who crashed and burned. Sharon Angle, Christine O'Donnell for the Senate, Carl Paladino here for New York governor. Were they just too radical for the voters in their states? Would it have been different if they had been running in solidly red states?
Possibly. If you look at a state like Kentucky, that was a place where a Tea Party candidate was going to have a good chance to win because they have a very, very small minority population in that state. You know, the natural Democratic demographic in that state is small. And so they, there are obviously places where the Tea Party is going to have a difficult time gaining traction, which I think is going to be a major factor in 2012 when we get to the presidential race, because the demographics just do not favor the Tea Party, generally speaking, in certain places where there are pockets of the population that are all white or nearly all white. They're gonna score some big victories, but if you look at the entire picture, it's going to be hard for them to win.
Now, Jill, a listener wonders whether nativism hasn't always been a factor in American politics.
Sure, it has always been a factor in American politics, and it comes and it goes. And, you know, one of the sort of consistent arguments against health care reform for the last century has been it comes from another country, you know, that sort of xenophobia is always mobilized to oppose healthcare reform and has been since the 19-teens, you know, when it was German socialism that was being introduced. And, you know, so that comes and it goes. I do think that the degree to which it was a factor here is important, partly because of the strength of those emotional appeals. Nativism, you know, sounds powerful, emotional notes for many American people. And a lot of the way that people talked about the Tea Party was, you know, even Sharon Engel in her concession speech talked about having been awakened, this kind of awakening sensibility, awakening to the sense that the country is slipping away from us. And, you know, the subtext of that is slipping away from us, we older white Americans, and to a different demographic, and slipping out. Somehow the boundaries between the United States and the rest of the world are becoming murkier. And in a literal sense, these kind of boundary enforcement issues with illegal immigrants. I think it was especially powerful in this election.
Just one more thing. What about some of the other distractions, like the Ground Zero Mosque, which people were using in campaigns far from Ground Zero?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, this is, again, just to follow up on what Jill was saying, this whole nativist idea was central to what the Tea Party was all about. I mean, just think about the word Tea Party. It's Americans versus, you know, foreign occupiers. You know, when they talked about Barack Obama, this whole idea that he, you know, it's not just that he's un-American, it's that he's literally not an American.
Born in Kenya.
You know, these people who are siding with these foreign Muslims in New York. You know, this is the kind of stuff that it really, really drives the Tea Party. It's real Americans and all these other people who are not Americans.
Well, just one more thing. Bill Clinton saw a major turnaround during his midterm elections, his first term. The Republicans took the Senate and the House, and then he won re-election. So are things totally bleak for Barack Obama?
Jill?
Well, you know, populism is about powerlessness. So if you rise to power on a populist wave, as these newly elected Republicans and Tea Party candidates have done, it becomes difficult, I think, to deliver legislation that satisfies populists, especially with a Tea Party whose whole argument is a hatred of government. To then become the government is, I think, a difficult step to make.
I think if you look at the results of last night, a lot of people are focusing on where the Republicans won. I focused on where they should have won and they didn't, like Delaware and places like Nevada perhaps. This whole – what happened yesterday was that the Tea Party won a kingmaking role in the Republican Party, and I think it virtually guarantees that whoever is nominated in 2012 is going to be somebody who has to be acceptable to that group of people. I just don't think that person can win the general election.
Well, we're already seeing a war. Karl Rove being critical of many of the Tea Party candidates.
Right.
And I'm sure that's going to be playing out over the next couple of years. My great thanks to both of you for being on our show as part of this Big Picture series. Matt Taibbi, his latest book is Griftopia. It is published by Spiegel & Grau. Jill Lepore, her latest book is The Whites of Their Eyes, published by Princeton University Press. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.